All right, welcome to the latest edition of Bengals Scribe Session. I am your Bengals beat writer, Paul Daner Jr., here with Cincinnati Inquirer. And here we are on our series, catching up with all former Bengals, because, you know, the fans like to complain these days about how tough it must be being a fan of a team that's made the playoffs 3 years in a row. But when you start catching up with some of the guys from the older days, you know that this franchise has certainly come a long way. No one would know that better than my guest today, Adrian Ross. Adrian, first of all, thanks for joining me, man.
Oh, no problem. Love to do it.
Adrian, of course, anyway, that follows the Bengals will remember 1998 to 03, 6 years. You had 34 starts in 90 games, totaled 127 tackles, 3 sacks, 1 pick, a man out of Colorado State, and you know, was a big part of those teams. And, you know, you were around for a long time. I guess what's the first thing anybody probably talks to you about, though, is probably the orange and black afro. That's like it became like your stamp. That's what everyone ended up remembering.
Yes, sir. The stripe, the Bengals helmet striped hairstyle. I guess, you know, that followed me through the career, and even at the end, I think I saw something where it was top 20 sports hairstyles or something. So that was one of the good things, and, you know, Bengal pride, and that was something I wanted to do for the pride. And, you know, at the time of getting there in Cincinnati, there was a lot of I just felt that there was a lot of hatred going on amongst inside of, whoa, don't wear the Bengal gear outside. And And my main thing was, like, you play for the Bengals. Like, so what? Let's go. You know, I want to bring change. Yeah. So,
how hard was that? Was that hard to do? Was that an easy? I mean, like logistically, was that a challenging thing to do?
It actually was, because I think the first year that I did it, you know, it wasn't as orange as I really, really wanted it to be able to do something like that. And the time, you know, I really got a feel for the women that deal with their hair from having the girl out there do my afro like that. You know, you had to bleach it first, and then you had to put the color in, and then you had to really take more care of it after it was dyed.
Yeah. I mean, it was something. I know that a lot of Bengals fans still talk about that and still love it, and I think it helped, you're right. What you were talking about, it did kind of help become a bit of a symbol of being prideful of the franchise, particularly, you know, when they ended up turning the corner. And I thought what was interesting about your tenure, you know, as I'm kind of going back and picking through older players and times that they were here. I try to pick them from different time frames because everybody has different perspective. Yours is super interesting because you came in 98 and there were some low years in there. But you ended, your last year was 03 when Marvin Lewis came in, and really it changed. Everything sort of started to change then. And that, you know, things like being prideful with something like that, it all kind of played together. How much did you notice that? I mean, did you notice that change in being proud to be a Bengal in your last year there?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, when Marvin came in, of course, there was a lot of changes made, not only with the team and the personnel, but cosmetically around the stadium. I mean, you know, moving from Synergy to Paul Brown Stadium, you know, like that's my area, you know, of being able to move from there and know what it used to be to go into the new stadium. But just even cosmetically, like the things that Marvin changed around the facility, you know, I was used to walking up the stairs and seeing just white walls or cement walls, and started going down the hallway and, you know, you started seeing Anthony Munoz, you know, and Ross and tight end, and, you know, you started seeing pictures of the history of the Cincinnati Bengals, you know, and then you started putting up pictures of weekly photos of the previous week, you know, so you just started looking like a, you know, that, you know, seeing the history of the franchise and how you were a part of it,
Yeah.
And I think that that was a big thing. And then I think for me, I was in my prime in that year. Like, the game just was moving so slow for me. Finally, you know, I really understood. And I think we had a nucleus of guys around there. You know, Brian Simmons was still there with me. You know, they brought in Kevin Hardy, and it was you know, that's when it started getting on the way. At that point.
Yeah. Now, so your last year there was 2003, and I don't know. Tell me if this was the case, because you obviously had your most, like you said, your most productive year that year, and you had a slew of starts. Did Marvin Lewis sort of give you a chance maybe that you felt like you didn't have before? Was that the biggest difference for you personally that year?
No, I mean, I don't even want to word it like that, because for me, when I look back on it now, I was one of the better linebackers there, period. I was one of the most versatile guys. I could play defensive end on third down. I think my status of being a free agent kind of held me back, you know, personnel-wise, you know, because, like, you look at my first year as a rookie, the last four games, I'm playing 50-something plays in front of a first-round pick, but mm-hmm. I couldn't get that start. Then I start the next year, but because it was a first-round pick, we switch in and out. So, you know, that's why I always hate, you know, hearing my stats, because it's like skewed, because, well, I'm sharing with someone else that I shouldn't be sharing with because I'm better than. And then you go all the way to my last year to where I start, but I have to start it outside because I have the skill to play it outside, when really I'm a middle backer.
Yeah.
Kevin Hardy was an outside backer that they played at middle. So you could look at, as well as we did, and I think that what always got overshadowed for me a lot was the fact that we would win. So when we have a game and, you know, and I would do really well, it was more news that the Bengals won than, you know, I'll say, if you looked at Baltimore, Ray Lewis gets 15 tackles. Well, people are going to talk about Ray Lewis getting 15 tackles.
Mm-hmm.
If we play the Tennessee Titans and Adrian Ross gets 12, 15 tackles, they're not going to talk about Adrian Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was very, it was very evident my last year in 2003. You know, you figure when I tear my ACL with 56 seconds left playing the Rams, and the next game I'm out against the Cleveland Browns, they rush for 269 yards. And the game before, when we played Cleveland, when I was there, they rushed for 69.
Right.
So, you know, I was a very key piece of a run stopper. I was the premier run stopper, bar none, period. And and then I think, you know, because of my status, the organization, the coaching staff, never want to talk about that, but the stats speak for themselves. And I think, well, we would have went to the playoffs that year, because there's no way no one would have ran for 200-something yards of me on the field. And we would have
right.
went to the playoffs and been 9-7. But,
yeah.
You know, I guess, what was that running back? Like, was it Lee Suggs? Like, we made Lee Suggs that day with me not being on the field, and you never heard of him again.
Yeah, you really didn't. Really didn't. That was the Lisa. I mean, the Lisa game. That's pretty much how that one will always go down. As not many people will forget, because it was quite a year. I mean, it was that immediate resurgence, and it was winning that the Bengals hadn't done in a long time. I'll get more to that stuff later. You mentioned you tore your ACL, and that was it. I mean, how close did you come to coming back from that? And how did that transition out into, you know, your post-football life at that point?
I came back really close. I think that, you know, what you don't know, you know, like, you don't know what you don't know. And I knew it was going to be tough, because I heard it so late in the season that, you know, I'd always heard that, you know, it takes 6 months to heal. So when you get your surgery in January, well, 6 months is, you know, you're like a month out of training camp.
Yeah.
So being cleared to run 6 months from there, you're not going to be in the premier athlete that you were, you know. And I think that's what a lot of people forget about. It's like they think, okay, well, and I always hear this on TV because now I, over the time then, I finally got to start watching ESPN First Take and all these other guys that talk. And they do that, well, it's like, the doctor said they're clear to go. He's cleared to go. It's like the doctor saying someone is cleared to go and them being the premier athlete that they were are two different things.
Yeah.
So I think that was a part of it for me was, you know, I was on my way. Basically, I was getting better every day. But I just felt that, you know, the things I did there, I felt that I was underpaid for a long time because you look like I ended up starting pretty much every year. You almost look at it, I was able to start at a lot of different linebacker positions, whether it was middle, whether it was Sam, whether it was Will, and being productive at all of them. And then to, you know, and then to just, you know, tear my knee and be cut a week before a training camp just to get me for cheaper. You know, that hurt. That hurt just to be like, okay, but it's the business. So it was what it was. And then, you know, then I was, had a chance to come back and I chose to go to Pittsburgh with, Dick LeBeau, really personally, it was Ricky Hunley was the linebacker coach, and if that's what you could call him. And
and so are you claiming he was underqualified or as a linebacker's coach?
Basically, I should have got another check for coaching him. you know, like. So, and it's just, you know, and that's me. I'm a football mind. I wasn't always the greatest athlete per se, but you know, I can lift the house up and that's what I do. I was powerful and I could hit and I know the game. So I know the adjustments, and that's why to me, I gelled well when Marvin was there, because Marvin Lewis would say certain things and he'd watch things on films and he'd give you exactly what we needed to look at, and when I honed in on that, he just made the game just be so slow for me, you know.
Yeah.
And he was a guy that was around Dick LeBeau as well. So as far as those guys, you know, I loved being with those guys as defensive minds, but it was hard to have a coach that wasn't as defensive mindful as those guys were, you know. And
yeah.
So I chose to go to Pittsburgh, and. And then there, you know, it was basically the same thing. You know, it was the numbers game and the money game. Being a 7-year veteran, you know, my money was up there. And then you had a James Harrison in camp, and then they had a second round draft pick, so you had me right in the middle. So I was the odd guy out there. And then I think Nate Webster was brought in. Nate Webster was going to be. He broke all of Ray Lewis's records,
right?
And he was being brought in as the middle linebacker. I guess what Kevin Hardy moved outside, which is what exactly should have been that way in 03. I should have been the middle linebacker. Kevin
right.
Hardy should have been Sam. So you know, it was hard sitting there watching it play out after I was gone. It's kind of like, okay, like, hey, Adrian, you're gone from the team. You're at home. And I'm like, well, you guys are there and you can't stop the run.
Right.
I mean, figure for 3 years after that is like, that was the problem of kind of winning and getting to the next level was they couldn't stop the run.
Yep. How hard is that? And I mean this generally, not just because of your own situation. You know, you talk to athletes all the time when they leave the game and the year or two afterwards. It's really hard because you become defined and you give so much of yourself to the game and you define yourself as a football player and that's what you are. How hard was it those first couple of years to be not a football player and watching, particularly when you're watching a team that you know that you could help and you know that you could have made a difference? How hard was that to sit there and watch for those first few years, and when did you kind of start getting past that feeling?
Oh yeah, it was very hard. I mean, it was very hard to sit, you know, especially to watch Cincinnati, because I felt that where we were going, and you know, and then actually to just, you know what that division was, just to know that you're going to have to stop the run from these teams in that division. And then, you know, so then you start looking at other teams. You know, me being a California kid, you know, I look at the Raiders. And I look at, you know, you go back, I was the player of the game in 03 when we played the Chargers. I shut LaDainian Tomlinson down, made the all-decade fullback look like he was a kid in Lorenzo Neal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those are the things that I say that, you know, Marvin talked about it. Those were all talked about behind closed doors. But media-wise, that was never talked about. But, you know, it's just like Ronnie Lott says, you play the game for respect. And so I had the respect for my peers because that tape goes around the league. So, you know, my boys, Joey Porter, they're watching the tape and they're calling, dang, Big A, you killed Lorenzo Neal. Man, what a little spot. You know, and so that's what I liked. But, you know, I would look at the Raiders. You know, I'm like, these guys are down the street, and I'm like, hey, I mean, Tomlinson probably made his career. He's not going to go in the Hall of Fame off of playing the Raiders. You know, just power-o to the house, power-o to the house, overtime, power-o to the house. And I'm like, yeah, I'm right down the street. All you got to do is bring me in. So it was hard. And but at the same time, I enjoyed life because I knew football was always going to be, you know, it's a part of Adrian Ross. And I love the game, but it didn't make all of me,
yeah.
You know. So being home at, you know, Thanksgiving and being able to be around the family and Christmas and all that stuff and just a lot of different things that, you know, you hadn't been around or people are asking you about for years, and you're like, oh, yeah, that is right. I haven't experienced that since, like, you know, my junior year in college, because even college you're going to bowl games.
Right.
You know,
right.
It was weird. It was really weird. You know, it probably was like started, you know, getting more normal to that, like my second year.
Yeah.
You know, then getting used to that. But I'm still on that same football schedule.
Yeah.
You know, it was tough watching.
Yeah. So I mean, and now you spent the last few years, you're living in Sacramento. And you just got enrolled as a sports agent now, and you're kind of just getting started with 3D sports agency, or what's the official title?
Yeah, 3D, 3 Diamond, but yeah, 3D sports agency.
And so you've gotten started doing that. Is, you know, what was the biggest reason you wanted to get into that? It's just being able to stay around the game and feeling like you really learned a lot about the NFL and the ins and outs and how it works, and kind of almost as a way to give back to today's players a little bit in that way?
Oh, yeah, just a way to give back. But I think that, you know, I'm a younger guy in that game, and there was a lot of things I did for myself. And just being an undrafted free agent coming into the game, and the things I did for myself, you know, setting up the Matt Backer Foundation, you know, having a radio show, getting on the TV show, getting myself a shoe deal, you know, these are all things that I felt that an agent should be assisting or either doing that they didn't do. So I have the knowledge that a lot of these other agents don't have, because they're not doing them. And then I have the football side of it. I can tell the kids what to bring in the training camp. I can tell them, you know, what to expect. I can tell them what to expect on pro day, you know, and so much more. I could tell them about their 401k that they're not going to be told about. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of other things behind the scene that I think that football players aren't told. And I actually want to even go beyond that. I want to change the game. You know, football players, athletes, period, it's entertainment. And I think that the public, because of how you come up, they're not telling these kids that they're entertainers. These kids still think that it's, well, oh, it's just, you know, I'm just a football player. It's like, no, just like there's Snoop Dogg and Jay-Z and, you know, a Madonna and Lady Gaga, you're in the entertainment business. Just go and look at the ratings. Football is the number one reality there is, period. And guys have to start looking at it like that. You know, guys want to look at it like, well, I'll wait until I become a star player. It's like you're already a star player, just the fact that you've made it to a team.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be a star player on the field. You know, the Carrot Top or Andy Dick doesn't wait to go on Oprah until they become a star entertainer or a star comedian. You know, whether they're A, B, or C, or however you look at it, you know, that's the industry that they're in, and I want to teach the players that's how they have to start looking at it.
Was being an entertainer? Did you view it that way when you started, or do you feel like the game has changed significantly to that's the way it is now?
I think it's that way now, but I don't think that everyone views it that way. I think the TV and the National Football League itself looks at it that way. You know, and there's so many things to me that are skewed that I think it's going to change over time. It's like, okay, a player can't advertise alcohol, but they can go on the Corona Light bus on Monday Night Football.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's just stuff like that. And it's like the players have to look at all those things that's being done that's right in front of their face.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you can't do this, but go ahead and we can have all the liquor and alcohol commercials on TV. And, you know, there's a lot more things, and obviously it's, you know, I don't want to announce to the world because that's why they got to come and sign with me.
Yeah, exactly. You got the agency. Secrets. You got to hold a few of those in your pocket for sure.
Exactly. You know, if I had Clowney or if I had, you know, but it's just the point of what I'm saying when you look at this whole Jay-Z thing. Jay-Z wasn't at the NFLPA testing to be certified agent like me and John Thornton, so he's not a football agent. But because he's Jay-Z, he gets talked about like, Jay-Z's an agent. Well,
yeah.
He is for basketball and baseball. He's not for football.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the entertainment side and because he's Jay-Z, he's signing guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, I'm not Jay-Z, but Jay-Z doesn't know more than Adrian Ross about football and about the business.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's what, you know, but he's, you know, he's going to sign big name guys because he's Jay-Z. And I'm like, for what?
Right.
That's what it is.
There's more to be learned from people that have really had to grind their way through an NFL career to get an understanding of it and kind of seen, like you did, you've seen both sides and how money will affect how teams view you when they see you as a marginal player. They try to make you a marginal player. It can really change. People that know more about the action, having perspective from the inside and how the coaches and the front office work together to make, you know, you've got to be proactive on that kind of stuff. It's really interesting. I mean, the whole way that the NFL has changed these days is crazy. I wanted to also get in. I do want to flash back a little bit. We've talked a lot about right now. I want to flash back a little bit because I find this, I'm just, you know, for background, I actually grew up in Cincinnati, so I know the old school Bengals for a while. You know, I'm the beat reporter now, but I've known this team for a while, and I'm just always amazed by the idea of the 90s and that the sort of the quote-unquote lost decades that we referred to before as there being a lot of not being proud to be a Bengal and stuff like that. When you came in, in 98 to that team, how challenging was it, and how palpable was it maybe that there had been some negativity built up? Or did you not feel that, or did you feel like there was optimism that things would turn around?
I think that being a linebacker at that time, you know, I think that I just happened to be, you know, time-wise, I just came in with, you know, with a great leader in Shaquille Spikes. You know, I think myself with him, you had Brian Simmons, you know, you had Knute Curtis, you know, mm-hmm. Steve Fogan. Like, there was like some young guns. And I think that because of that, I think we were able to look at it differently. And just the personality of those guys, you know, they were hungry and they wanted to do well. So I think that my perspective was just different. I come from Colorado State, and well, we were second most winning this championship program behind Florida State. You know, and but it was kind of weird for me because I see all these guys that are coming from these, you know, Southern schools, SEC, and you know, Big Ten, and you know, they're like Colorado State, like where's that at? And I'm like, what? Like, what are you talking about? Like, how do you not know what I said? Like, we're one of the tops of the nation. Like, come on. And yeah. So I think because I was a winner, I just wanted to do my part and just and I had, you know, being from the Bay Area, you know, I saw the Super Bowls and I remember the Niners playing the Bengals and you know, and I was a John Madden player, so I knew it's Jeff Blake and I knew how good Carl Pickens was. Mm-hmm. From going to Colorado State, I knew Darnay Scott, you know, as far as, you know, like how tall the wide receiver was, how fast he was. So I knew the talent on the team, and I knew it was a mindset more than we didn't have the talent. Mm-hmm. So I guess for me, it was I felt that sense of, you know, like it wasn't – it had been a while, but I didn't think it was that far off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the other guys didn't either. You know, you had the Willie Anderson, you know, that was able to be there with Dea Takio. And so I don't know if I'm answering the question.
No, you are. No, absolutely. You really are. I mean, it's really interesting how you fight that. Was there a point? I guess. I'll phrase it this way. When you came in '98, you were there through '03. Which of those, of all those seasons, which one was the toughest one to try and get through, and why was that?
I think which year was that Bruce Coslett, that last Bruce Coslett year?
Right, yeah, that was it was 2000 where Bruce was let go after three games.
Yeah, I think that was tough. You know, to just. It was like, wow, you're sitting there, you know, you have your coach walk out, you know, you have your coach walk out on you. And, you know, and then just prior to it, you know, we just had some games where you're, you know, just the pregame speech was just like, okay, go out there and see if we can win one. Huh? Okay. you know, and
win one for the Gipper, exactly.
Exactly, and so it, you know, I think that was tough because not for me performance wise because I'm self motivating and but just, you know, I think some other guys need the motivation.
Yeah.
So. You know, I think overall as a team, that's what was tough because, you know, you just had guys that were just ready to, you know, like they're just ready to get out of there. Or, you know, I think another big part of those years was it was always someone being brought in either to be the savior, they were looked upon to be the savior of the team, or there was a free agent like, okay, we got him now. He was, you know, it's like the whole Neil O'Donnell. Or, you know, it's like the Neil O'Donnell did good in the Super Bowl, you know, and he's coming here starting. Or we drafted Peter Warwick.
Yeah.
So he's the savior. We drafted Akili Smith, and we're going to go with him now. And, you know, and like to me, I think it was always, you know, like, well, these guys are going to be the savior. And I think that played a part in a lot of other people's performance because you had talented players there that, weren't being kept on the roster, or you know, they're being let go in free agency. Where to me, I think it started making other players look like, well, what's the reward for performing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you had a Sam Shade who was up there in tackles when he was there, and you know, boom, gone.
Yeah.
You know, and you didn't see that okay, this person performed and they were rewarded. But you would see a free agent come in and get paid money.
Right. It didn't make any sense. It's funny you bring up that point, Adrian. It's a great point because we hear the Bengals these days get a lot of criticism for not being super active in the free agent market. But they hold back and spend most of their money now on guys within. By rewarding those guys in their second contracts, they've been doing that from Leon Hall, Andrew Whitworth, and are trying to do that now with Andy Dalton and with AJ Green and Vontaze Burfict, and they're trying to reward the guys that do play within and keep the money in house without. I mean, you can speak to this better than anybody. I mean, how much is that? That it just sends the wrong message. Did you feel that as a player? It was sending the wrong message that, hey, we're going to reward the people from outside rather than the ones from within. It probably did make a lot of guys not want to play as hard and not understand why they should.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's exactly what it was. You know, it was, this unproven kid's coming in from college and, you know, well, you know, everyone's going to be the poster boys and whatnot and all this stuff. So, you know, you're getting these guys, it was like, you know, the star players are fighting for, well, wait a minute, like, I've been here for a minute and I'm producing, you know, why are you not talking about me? And, okay, like, do you not value me? And, I mean, all the way down to just everybody else. I mean, it's like, you know, always look at it like for myself now. I mean, like, you figure I always play on special teams. And there was this thing, like, to me, that were done personally. I don't mean to me, but I mean, like, the one year when Ron Dugans was performing on special teams.
Mm-hmm.
And he was making a lot of tackles. Well, when you look at the stats, I was only two tackles away from Ron Dugans, but on the Pro Bowl ballot, it was only his name.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, there were some games I didn't even play. I didn't even play those teams because I was starting. So
yeah.
I'm a starting linebacker, and it's over, you know, and we go play Tennessee Titans, and I go and make four special team tackles. But, you know, it's almost like, well, okay, well, Adrian does this sometimes, Adrian does that, you know, so it just kind of got, and I looked on the ballot, and I'm like, what? Like, why is there one name?
Well, mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
When you look at the fullback, it's going to say Corey Dillon and Brandon Bennett. It's not going to just say Corey Dillon. And, you know, it was things like that for me that, you know, there was a lot of things to me that were overhyped and there was a lot of things that were underhyped, which you can get anywhere, but it was just weird to come from. It's like, what's not being seen, you know? And there was a lot of status. I think there was too much status going on. Versus when you look at, like, say, a New England that you always hear about for years, like, they'll play anybody that's performing. You know, so you get the Danny Woodhead that it didn't matter how he was acquired or whatever, he's performing, he's playing.
Yep.
You know. And,
yeah, you're exactly right. And I think that was probably, and you can speak to this better maybe in way it was in 2003, that was really a big part of Marvin's culture change, wasn't it? Was the idea of play your way, we'll play whoever. The stat, his goal was sort of to erase the status. And I know today the Bengals have as many undrafted players on their 53 as anybody in football almost, and it's been a big part of them. Is there just they'll play whoever's playing the best? Do you think that was that kind of a big part of the culture change that Marvin instituted in 2003?
Yeah. I mean, most definitely. I mean, I think it was that way just even before the season started. You know, like it was almost, you know, if you were like an old Bengal and you didn't end up starting, you were gone. And you know, some of their guys were being brought in. I think that was, you know, and he had to make some changes and, you know, do some things that I don't think he does now or he would do. But I think that one thing that went on there was. During that time was the planted leadership. You know, I know me and Brian Simmons didn't personally like we love Kevin Hardy. I mean, Kevin Hardy is a leader. But, you know, sometimes I think it was overly, like, this is, you know, Kevin, come here. And Kevin, you know, it's like, well, what, so now the fact that we've been here for 6 years doesn't mean anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Kevin just hopped here and Kevin hopped there, and then you're placing Kevin in a position that he's never played. Like, he was never a middle linebacker.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of actually not funny because I actually tore my knee, but that game, like, when you go back and you look at that Ram game, I mean, I was dominating for as much as I could out there, and I think Marvin yelled at me for something. It was like me getting close to Marshall Faulk, but if I would have actually tackled him on that play, I would have done my job and Kevin's job.
Mm-hmm.
So, like,
yeah.
So the fact that you're yelling at me, I was pissed, and I was like, I said, move me to middle linebacker and see what the hell happens. And that's just the point that I was at with it, because I would get a lot of, you know, Leslie Frazier would come over to me on the bench, and he'd hand me the paper, and he'd be like, Adrian, why are you over here? And I'm literally looking at him like, do you see that's number 56? Like,
yeah.
Why would I be over there? Oh, that's Brian. But, it kind of came down, like, you know, to me it looked like I felt like there was a big class thing. Like, okay, well, Adrian must have messed up. You know, it's like, no, like, Adrian did mess up. But then when I'm doing well, you guys are taking me off the field. And I think, and you can go look at the film, but you look at, I was such a run stopper that year that what teams started doing was anytime they went three wide receivers, we'd go nickel. So they'd take me off and put in, like, Terrell Roberts or whoever at nickel. And when you look at the Niner game, you look at the Ram game, I forgot who else we played, but that's what teams started doing to take me off. They go three wide receivers on first down and run the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And because Adrian Ross couldn't cover. And
right.
I'm like, well, but we play the Rams and I'm covering the wide receiver there. Or,
yeah.
You know, it's like stop going off of one-on-one coverage in the summer camp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well,
yeah.
Okay, I got beat a couple times against the tight end, but, like, it's like people get used to stuff and people get better, but it's like you're taking me off the field and you can't see that they're running the ball every time I'm off the field, and then they go regular and they pass the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And so that to me is, I think that was a, I mean, I don't think, I know for a fact, because I could see it on tape, and you saw it, and I saw it all the time. I mean, guys would stay on the sideline, and they did that the 49er game.
Yeah.
Like, well, that was the one snow game.
I want to do this. I'm just going to run down a list of a few names and players, and you just tell me what you associate with them or any stories that you have about them. I'll start with Carl Pickens. Is that a good place to start?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. I mean, like, when I got there, I mean, I'm a John Madden video game junkie, and for whatever reason, when I look back on it now, it's funny that I actually played with him. Like, I would play with the Bengals, and because they were that team that on the video game, they were good because of Jeff Blake, Darnay Scott, and Carl Pickens. And whatever era you want to go, they always had a nice running back. And so guys wouldn't pick that team. And so I knew they wouldn't know how to stop me. I knew Carl Pickens would just jump up and catch the ball. And so when I got to the Bengals, you know, as a kid you always hear, oh, so-and-so's a big wide receiver and so-and-so's big. And so big in my mind was just totally different, but I understood it when I got there because I saw how tall Carl Pickens was. And, you know, but then literally getting out there and seeing how he would catch the ball. And it was just great to see a veteran like that. And that's just the true definition of a veteran player and his approach to the game and just how nonchalant he was about a lot of things. And he just kept the locker room just, you know, like he was a, he was a comedian, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I, you know, learned that, you know, to be able, when you know the game, you're able to speak up on how you can help the team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's what Carl did. I think when we played Baltimore Ravens, and we, you know, they blew us out the first time we played them, and then I think Bruce Cosgrove was asking questions, and Carl raised his hand like, well, they have a rookie corner out there. Like, let's go at him. I think it was Chris McAllister. And boom, I think first play of the game, boom, we go right at him. And, you know, it's like, Carl's like, you see what I'm saying? Like, let's go.
Yeah.
You know, and those are the things that, you know, you're able to see that when those guys leave, it's like, who's, you know, who on offense or whoever's going to step up and be able to, you know, make those kind of decisions. And I think that, you know, but besides the Corey Dillon, you know, that I don't think that there was a guy at a wide receiver spot that, you know, could come up and say that. But I don't want to go into a whole other subject.
Right. Okay, let's Tequio Spikes.
Man, that's my dog right there. I mean, from day one.
He just quit playing. I mean, you've been out of the game for a while, and he was still going at it. Did you think that he was like the bionic man or something? I mean, you guys pretty much came in together.
Right, yeah. I got to spend a little bit more time with him when he was out here in the Niners, and, it was, that's Spikes. I mean, like, you know, he's going to be in shape. You know, he's going to be able to run. You know, he's going to have the strength. And, of course, like, the leader that he is, you know. And I just remember just being over there at Spinney, and one day we had a workout on the field. I think it was our first mini camp, and we were running, and we were both tired because he looked at me and we were bent over. I looked at him, and he just gave me that, come on, dog, man, let's go. We got one more, you know. He pushed me, I pushed you, and it was just him. It was just who he was, you know. Like, he wanted to win, and he was gonna do anything that he could, you know, that he could do to win, and. You know, it didn't matter. It didn't matter that I was a free agent and he was a first-round pick. You know, so I was around him a lot. You know, I stayed with him during the OTAs, or, you know, remember, we didn't have OTAs at first.
Yeah.
My first couple of years. But, yeah, after, like, that's what I stayed with. So, you know, great leader, I'll say that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll go ahead and play off that. Spinney Field.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I did not like that place. I mean, just being a California kid, I think played a lot into it, because driving to those facilities day one was not what I pictured the NFL to be like. You know, it was like, okay, you know, I'm coming from Cal State, and they pick me up from the airport, and I'm driving in, and, you know, you see Kentucky, and then you see the freeway and the bridge, and then all of a sudden you turn, and I'm like, is this Gotham? Did we just turn to Gotham City? And then all of a sudden you see this building, you know, you see some orange, you're like, okay, like, this looks like this is a building, you know. But I was like, where are they taking me?
Yeah.
And, you know, the smell over there, and, oh, boy, it was.
What was the smell? Try to describe the smell. I've heard about this before. Try to describe the smell at Spinney Field.
The smell is like, if you can picture, like, rotten eggs, and then, like, that old, like, still river water or something, or, like, you know, when you, like, when you walk by, you just smell, like, just rancid water. Like, that's what it would smell like at times, and you have to sit out there and run and work out and condition and play and focus, and Oh,
beautiful.
Those
were the days, right? You were very happy about moving over to Paul Brown Stadium, needless to say, right?
Very happy.
Yeah. Okay, I'll keep running down the list here.
Akili Smith. I think young, talented guy that, again, like I spoke on earlier, that I think a lot of guys were, a lot of things were going on to where younger guys were actually being brought in to be the savior, and I think that was the situation that he was thrown in. Not everybody is going to be Peyton Manning, now even more so it seems like these first-round picks are being asked to, like you have Andrew Luck, who's being brought in to play right now.
Yeah.
But when you look at Andrew Luck, his 4 years of college, or I think he went four, he was able to develop. I saw him actually at Stanford, because being an agent, I was looking at Richard Sherman, and I saw him when he was a redshirt freshman. I was like, that's the next John Elway, because I saw his ball, how he was throwing him. And, he flew under the radar a little bit because Stanford wasn't winning those big, wasn't winning the number of games to put them up on the map early, but he was later, obviously. But I think, like Akili, he had that 1 year at Oregon, and so in their evaluation of him, I think that, he had a nice arm, nice mobility, but I think he was thrown out there too early with not enough coaching, for him to be able to produce.
Yeah.
Still at the same time, you had a little bit of accountability on his part, too, as his preparation in what he needs to do to be ready because of the environment. So I go back, they all play hand in hand. When you come in and you treat someone like they're just a superstar already, versus holding them accountable for what they need to do. And I talk to kids all the time. He's a California kid too. He's now in San Diego, so probably almost every couple weeks, if not text. And
yes.
He owns a lot of that himself now, as far as, man, what was I doing? Or what was this that I was doing? Which in anything in life. I think that's how you have to look at it. It's like I think a lot of people hold athletes like, they think that, you're such a grown man, like, what's this guy doing or what's that guy doing? I'm like, you're a kid.
Yeah.
You're really a kid when you get there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to the leadership, coaching, management, whatever to, I feel that like organizations that prepare their players like that, it's going to be better for the player and the team.
Yeah. No doubt. I'll do one more on my list here. One more on the list. Corey Dillon.
CD, that's my other boy. Corey. Yeah, Corey is just I mean, you're talking about, I think, a future Hall of Famer. I think a guy that, and like, I think that in just talking to you now, like, you guys see the theme of, what I was saying earlier with just, you have a guy like that, like, he goes in the category of like a Carl Pickens, just dominating. Great performer that, because you didn't have wins, wasn't talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Until he had to break Jim Brown's record, and then it was like, well, Corey Dillon. But now me, I'm a knockout artist and I'm a hitter. So the bigger they are to me, I like them. So him, my teammate, I never really had to go against him too much. So we used to always talk. But every other free agent that came in, when the topic would come up about, you know, who's the hardest running back to tackle, you know, other guys would just be bringing up, you know, different guys' names, and it would always be, it would always have to be someone from another team, and they'd do that 28. And then you know, for me, I always have to look at that like, wow, you know, because I would never say that because I never, you know, really have to tackle him.
Yeah.
And but just the way Corey ran and just how much he wanted to win, I mean, he's just the ultimate competitor. You know. You know, like I was always over at his house, and he was a Madden guy, and the things he would do to win on the video games. I mean, you know, it just, you know, it's like you hear the stories about Jordan. You know, like things that, you know, like he'll do anything, and he'll just cheat and do all this stuff to to beat you in golf or something. You know, and that's what Corey was. He wanted to win, and he wanted to be the best at what he was there for. And,
yeah.
And I think he did a good job of that. And, you know, so much so that he wanted to win that, you know, he felt that what was going on there, I have to get out of here. And I think that, you know, I don't know what the temperature is over there, but I think, you know, I kind of look at the history of his, what do you have, 7 years there, and, you know, him actually staying there and getting a deal and so on and so forth. But it's like you look at the Bengals' history and you have a lot of players like that to where you just wonder what the – are those guys just lost in history for how they left? You know, like you have a,
yeah.
you have Paul Pickens, you have a Corey Dillon. You know, are those relationships trying to be mended because – you know, that was the basis of their career, of where they were.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, are those guys, you know, going to be brought back to be honored or to be a part of, you know?
Would that mean something? Would that mean something to a guy like you if guys from those teams, whether it was a Corey Dillon or really anybody, even in the mold of Big Willie who left on great terms, or guys like that, would that mean something to you as a player who was a part of those ugly years to see guys brought back and honored for the blood, sweat, and tears that they did give to the franchise?
Most definitely. I mean,
yeah.
Because like you look at that, that's I mean, the 278 yards is history. And, you know, the 400 and something total rushing yards was, you know, the most in the modern era of total rushing yards that day. You know, now that's, you know, like all those guys were on that team and, you know, it happened. And, I mean, I think it would mean a lot to me. I think it would mean a lot to those guys because, you know, they actually did it, you know, like they actually performed, you know, and that's the part of the history of that team that I think that just, to me, it almost just gets lost because, you know, there's no a relationship there. And there's, you know, I think that those were monumental days.
Absolutely. I mean, a day like that. No, I mean, I'd have to go back. I'm trying to remember exactly. There were only but like three or four passes thrown in that game. I mean, it was one of the most amazing games in the way that it played out in NFL history. Just ridiculous. But I often wonder about that because there's not, you know, there's no Ring of Honor. There's no Bengals Hall of Fame, and that's a hot topic of discussion here in the city is. Why isn't there should be more reaching out to former players of the past? And as a guy who was a part of those teams, I didn't know if that's something that players that you talk to from those teams still talk about or wish that there was, or the most just kind of move on and not really care.
I think the most move on, but I think the guys care when you get someone like Adrian to bring it up. Because I brought, like, you know, because I talk to everybody, and that's just been me over time. And I know, you know, Corey, you know, he has his ring and, you know, he can, quote unquote, not care about whatever stuff, but I got on him for, and here's what I mean by about when your own organization doesn't bring anything up, how does the rest of the public really, really know? Because I always tell people now, I just so happen to be in the old decade, like the real, real old decade, even though it was becoming newer and we were probably more advanced in college than when we got to the pros. You know, yeah. Like, so tape was still on VHS. It was tape. It was on VHS. I was one of the first linebackers asking, "Can I have a DVD? Like, I only have a VCR to watch this film. Can I have a DVD?"
Yeah.
So, you know, we started moving into the DVDs, and you know, now they're all on the iPad. But you know, it was the beginning of DirecTV. So really, only if you had your son or a friend or someone playing, you had a DirecTV. Now everyone watches all the games. So during that time, you have the Corey Dillons and stuff like that that people didn't know about. You know, they didn't get to see. They heard or whatever, but they didn't really get to see because mm-hmm. we weren't see. You know, people always ask me, like, well, how did it feel to play on Monday night? And I'm like, well, I never played on Monday night.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I never got to play. I never played the playoffs. And,
yeah,
you know, and so a part of that, you know, you have to look at it. It's like Corey, like, how does Corey Dillon not make the all-decade team?
Right.
And so I told him that, and he was like, oh, I don't care. But then I said, Shaun Alexander did. And he's like, what? You know, you know, and it's just amazing to me when you go and look up their stats. You know, I think Corey's at 10,000 something, and Shaun Alexander was at like 9 something.
Right.
You know, because of all those touchdowns that year. You know, it's like, it appears like almost that Shaun Alexander was better. And obviously, whatever that vote was done, you know, he beats the Corey Dillon out.
Mm-hmm.
Which, even though he's probably even in the running, because you have those earlier Bengal years where no one really saw you.
Right, right, right.
Until the record.
Well,
which I guess, say, even with that 278 yards, he still has the least amount of carries for breaking the record.
Yeah.
Like, he has the highest yards per average. I think Jamal Lewis broke it, and then Adrian Peterson broke
right.
it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's funny to hear you talk about this guy, you know, and just hearing you talk over this last hour, you really associate with guys that aren't afraid to say the way they feel, right? I mean, that's kind of you, right?
Oh, yeah. Most definitely.
Well, I mean, no doubt. And I appreciate you, you know, coming and joining me and talking. It was really great hearing all the old stories. And I'm glad to hear everything going well out there for you in Sacramento. What else do you have going on? Obviously, you got the agent thing going on. What else is going on out there that we can give
a little bit?
Well, I mean, like, I had the Matt Bagger Foundation, and,
yep.
You know, I was best of Sacramento in 2008 with that. I used to do the celebrity basketball game, and, you know, I raised money. I do a lot of talking to schools, and I mm-hmm. talk to them about education and how important it is. And I just like being a real physical figure to the youth and to show that, you know, they can see stuff on TV, but it, you know, it means a lot when they can come up and actually touch you and know you're real, and that's just mostly what I do. But the main thing is the agency right now.
Yep.
I want to get players, and you know, and then there's the marketing side of it. You know, I'm an agent, but I do marketing too. You
yeah.
know, because some guys need to get marketing. Like, some guys don't have their names out there, and if they listen to the podcast and they hear what I'm talking about, they don't have to be the Corey Dillon where no one's talking about them. You know,
mm-hmm.
certain guys that led the NFL in tackles. You know, so there's one particular kid that led the NFL in tackles, and I don't see him on TV. No one hears about him. No one knows him.
Right.
But they know who Luke Kuechly is. Luke
mm-hmm.
Kuechly is.
Yeah.
You know, there's
right.
another guy, and there's another Seattle middle linebacker that just won the Super Bowl that no one talks about. And there's a guy on the Bengals linebacker, the guy in Seattle that I feel that people should be hearing about him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, there's plenty. I'm glad to hear you talking about all this stuff. And now, one of the things we like to do on the podcast, you know, we're musical people around here. I'm sure you've got your music of choice, and we like to let our guests pick what song takes the podcast out. So if you had to pick a song, try and take this out. What do you want? What's your music of choice?
So we can go Biggest Boss Rick Ross.
That's it. We're going with that one, man. All right. So the Biggest Boss Rick Ross will take us out. Adrian Ross, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Bengals fans, I'm sure it'll be real cool to talk to you again. And make sure you keep track of everything he's doing out there. And hey, maybe we'll have you back again sometime.
Oh, not a maybe. You're going to have me back. I'm going to be back. We're going to talk some football, and I'm going to show you my football mind.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I know football. We can talk about it. I'm going to be back. Let's get it cracking.
I love it. I love it. We're going to be a regular. Adrian Ross, thanks very much. Rick Ross will take us out. Thank you, Adrian. We'll talk to you next time on Strike. What a hater got to say, I made a couple $1 million last year dealing with. Still in the streets, strapped with them things. She in love with a G, so she tatted my name. I'm the biggest boss that you've seen thus far. 10 black made backs back to back in the lane. I'ma make it rain, then I'ma make it back. You are just a lame little homie, that's a fact. Working with the police, acting like you know me. Fresh out of jail already in your got a fresh line up, yeah, fresh outfit. About to have a parking lot on smash. Plus I got a Chevy with a 454 in the hood. Got 125 on the dash. I'm the biggest boss that you've seen thus far. I'm